everybody. This is Armand DeMille with you with The Positive Mind. Armand DeMille with Roberta Maria Atti here today. Hello, Roberta.
Hi, Armand.
Oops, don't hear. There we go. Try again.
Hello, Armand.
Hi there. Oh, these funny things that happen in life. You know, we were looking at some of the paradoxes of medicine. But when we talk about a paradox, the way we're using it, think about this. You're poor. You live on a farm. You live on a beautiful farm, and you love the fact that when your doors are open in the middle of the summer and the windows are open, you get this beautiful breeze that kind of goes through, comes down over the plains. And it's a nice feeling. You've lived on farms in Italy, Roberta?
I have.
Kind of a special thing, the wind, huh?
Yes.
The wind, you know? But then somebody realizes that you're growing something good. You know, they see that your pea pods are worth money. And so someone comes along and says, hey, I'll buy your farm for $1 million or $2 million or $5 million. And how could you turn it down? So you take the money and you are now wealthy. So you go live in an apartment in Manhattan. You've always wanted to go to New York and you live in an apartment. And now those open windows, well, they're not so good anymore because there's a little too much smog and certainly a lot of noise out there. So you close your windows and you condition your air and you lose that breeze. It's one of the things you never thought about when you thought about going from the farm to New York. You forgot about the wind. Paradoxes are all over life. Things we can't anticipate. Things that we didn't expect, like love is filled with paradoxes. The hottest relationships that we usually have, the most dynamic, passionate relationships, usually have the worst outcomes. How does that happen? The more you love someone, the more they can hurt you, and the more hurt you may get as a result of it. Think about work. You dream about finally being the boss. And from my great fortune cookie wisdom comes the expression, a boss works three times as hard for twice the money. The other thing about being a boss, let's say you just want a promotion and you become promoted and you become a supervisor. Now, as a supervisor at work, you lose your friends because you're supervising people. That means you can't be a close friend to them anymore. That means you have to watch them and report to the upper-ups. So being a supervisor means losing friends on the job, losing a family, being envied. You know, even some people dream about fame, and they wonder, oh, if only I could be famous, if only I could get my name well-known. And, you know, you hope, you just wish one day you'll be discovered like a famous rock star. And then being famous, you know, you think it's wonderful. People are just going to admire you and love you, and they're going to come after you and search for your signature, and that's okay. You don't mind that so much. But then you get the paparazzi. You get the photographers. You get the people who want to photograph you while you're on your toilet. And if you're famous and you live in a world of fame, you understand you have to live with that, but you must live a private, secluded life. You're not free to walk outside anymore without consideration. How about living longer? Living longer. What's wrong with living longer? Living longer. You know, we have a population that is now living longer than it did 30 years ago. But now we have an overpopulation. You know? Now we have new things to deal with, medical expenses. So we were thinking about the different things we have to deal with in life. And we were going to bring to you some of the... This is all kind of triggered by one particular health paradox that came around, or two or three. But it's such a fascinating subject. Such a fascinating subject.
Well, maybe we should... describe the meaning of the word, Armand. What do you think? A paradox can be a situation or a person who displays contradictions, meaning you expect something and the outcome is the opposite of what you expected, something like that. And so I'm sure you all like we did this morning as we were discussing the program, you will realize that life is filled with paradoxes, with things that we do because we expect a certain outcome, we hope for a certain outcome, and then we get a different outcome, like the all of the fear engendered by the French paradox, which, being a nutritionist, of course, is one of my favorite ones. And that's a paradox whereby it seems that the French can eat just about anything they want. And we've been studying them for half a century to figure out how come they can get away with it. And they get a fraction of the heart disease and cardiovascular illnesses that we get. They eat three times as much fat, saturated fat. So that's a paradox. You know, how come? Of course, I could explain that one, but just to give you an example of what a paradox is, or what we mean by a paradox.
And here's something that happened recently. There's, for a long way, people who are obese were kind of hoping that there would be kind of a solution, and there's been a solution that's been creeping up, and it's called taking out your stomach. You know, they remove the stomach, and they do this surgery, which has become very popular. It's called a weight loss surgery, and here's what they do. They get in there, it's called bariatric surgery, and they remove part of or all of the stomach, and they sew the other things together. And so this has worked. It's worked tremendously. People lose 100, 200 pounds.
And then they disappear, too.
Well, that's not the paradox, though.
Well, no, but what I mean is the... Okay.
What happens is that an article in a personal journal in the Wall Street Journal, this fascinating thing, is there's a certain ache and a certain pain that happens in a stomach that has always been filled with food. They don't know to describe it as hunger or not, but it's kind of a gnawing feeling. And they couldn't do anything to get rid of it. None of the medications could do anything to get rid of it until one particular person who lost 135 pounds, explained what cured it, and what cured it was alcohol. Yep, she took a shot of alcohol, and that feeling went away. So what do you think has happened to a large majority of the number of people who have had this bariatric surgery? Alcoholism. They drink the way they ate. Mm. Remember, these are compulsive people. So now they discover a thing that makes them feel good, and they find out a large number of them now are drinking like fish, if fish drink. And this is within 8 months, usually within 8 months after surgery. Food cravings vanish, drinking increases, alcoholism in place of what you had, you know?
Yes, well, this is a medical paradox, the one you just mentioned, Armand. Another medical paradox could be what happened with antibiotics, where, you know, my father was a pharmacist, and I remember how excited he was about antibiotics, because when he was a kid, people died from very simple infections. And so he used to tell the stories of how amazing it was when antibiotics were discovered. And it started out with the discovery of penicillin, which is a mold, actually. When antibiotics were discovered, it was one of the greatest discoveries in medical science, because suddenly things like syphilis, which is a nasty venereal disease that kills people in a horrible way, could be cured with a couple of pills. Leprosy, which is another disease that causes horrible symptoms. And it was one of these things that people were horrified at, the idea that they could get leprosy because there was no hope for it. Two pills cure leprosy. So we're talking about a great discovery, possibly the greatest discovery in medicine ever. Well, look at what happened. Because of this discovery, antibiotics were used and overused. And what has happened now is that we have bacteria that is so resistant to antibiotics that there is nothing that can kill this bacteria. And that's a paradox.
And the virulence of these bacteria actually wind up going into. You know, the antibiotics are also fed to many of the animals, the chickens and the cows. They get fed that, so we wind up digesting them passively. So since antibiotics are used so much, we wind up eating them in the very food that we get often. Mm-hmm. And when we eat that food, we become resistant to the very thing that would cure us.
Yes. Right.
So that's like one of the kind of things, you know, who would have thunk it? I think healers of all kind probably started off with a good intention. You know, as a kid, people who want to be doctors, nurses, veterinarians, we were trying to think of what kind of children, what do children aspire to be if they're going to be in the healing profession, the ones who want to fix things. Veterinarians, I remember everybody wanted to be an animal doctor.
Oh, I did.
Some people wanted to be a doctor. You've actually heard children who want to be a dentist. I can't understand that. What child would want to be a dentist?
Surprised me too, but yes, I did meet children who wanted to be dentists. Mm-hmm.
Now, I am sure I can't think of a child that wants to be an obstetrician. Maybe I want to be a baby doctor, sure.
Obstetricians, yes. Maybe not a gynecologist or a urologist, you know. Maybe
they
not
wouldn't
of them
think
more
of subspecialties.
No.
Or a child may say, I want to be a brain surgeon just because it sounds so intriguing.
Mm-hmm.
But the intention of most children who want to enter a nursing, a healing profession is usually doctors, nurses, veterinarians. They want to, sometimes if you ask them what kind of doctor do you want to be, a lot of them will say, I'd like to be traveling doctors who work with the poor. Their intention is to help people. You know, I imagine that Doctors Without Borders is, for some people, just the absolutely ideal job.
Sure.
Travel around the world, help people out, low remuneration, no fame, but you're just doing your job. It's only later that the contaminants of intention, like money, power, competition, enter. So I think all healers generally start off with great intention. And in every healer, there's a thread of good intention. Very few people do medicine, which includes even the drug companies, with bad intention. I don't think they have a bad intention. There are a few. I'm sure there's a few. There are a few during the war, and we probably have a few working for us in the government who experiment on humans, you know, to develop some new toxin that we could use for war.
But see, something seems to happen, Armand, between the moment a person decides that they want to do something good for humanity and they go about searching the right way to do that, and the moment they join some kind of system or institution whereby the survival of the system and the institution takes priority over the mission.
That's probably it.
So I think that, I think that everyone who ends up working in the health field, we could assume safely that they started out with some very good intention. But once they become a piece in the big machine, a part of that big system, now they have to serve the system first because the system feeds them. And so if we don't serve the system, then we don't have a system, then we can't do what we want to do. So all the priorities get confused and jumbled up, and now we end up with a pharmaceutical company. Let's talk about asthma for a moment.
No, let's go back a second, though. Before we get to that, what you're saying just about the medical profession, the real beginning of it seems to happen, and here are some of the very interesting paradoxes we find in medicine. An article from Civil Justice, which is a publication of the Harvard Medical Practice Study, first published in 1991. Anyway, in this study, they studied malpractice, and they looked at malpractice suits. They looked at the kind of lawsuits that were being brought against doctors. Now, here you are, a physician, and you start off as a physician, and you're told, in order for you to have a license, you must have malpractice protection.
Insurance, right.
Right? And so what happens, because of malpractice suits being put out there, some frivolous and some very well-meaning, you know, some that are deserved, people start suing the doctors, and the doctors need to have more and more insurance. So their insurance rates go up, just as the hospital insurance rates go up, and so they have to charge more and more money. The cost of medicine has to be so much more careful, because now what a doctor might do by instinct, he has to think about. If somebody gets hit by a car in the street, a doctor's afraid to touch him because he may get sued for malpractice for practicing outside of his specialty. So they become frightened, and therefore, if you get hit in the street, it's very unlikely for a doctor to be there to help you. That's a paradox. Now, another thing that happens is the cost of your insurance goes up further and further, and what happens with the insurance companies? Well, there we were in the 60s, all of us, with insurance that was like manna from heaven. If you wanted to go into therapy, you could just charge your therapy to the insurance. If you wanted to do things, just charge it to the insurance, and insurance would pay for it. Paradox. Insurance rates go up. Everybody gets forced into managed care. And here we are now sitting with this managed care practice that's practically mandatory, even for Medicare. And so people are living with the kind of medical care that is truly substandard. Based on what? Based on this thing a long time ago that started with how we were treating and how we, our relationship with our physicians.
Which was a good intention.
A good intention.
Yeah. I mentioned asthma.
Yeah, what about asthma?
Because a lot of advances have been achieved in the field of pulmonary medicine in relation to asthma, meaning that in terms of the medications we have now, they really are a lifesaver. The bronchodilators that you can take a puff and they open up your bronchi, for an asthma sufferer, just ask them what it feels like to feel like you're suffocating and to have something that you can just open your mouth, inhale once or twice, and you're breathing normally. It's a miracle. Well, guess what? Ever since those medications, which there are several different kinds of, but they're all basically bronchodilators, ever since they've been on the market and they've been used to treat asthma, the rate of the incidence of death from asthma attacks has skyrocketed.
In an article from the New York Times by Dr. Sarah Blaxley, she did a report on this, talking about the number of people who have died from asthma. You see, asthma used to be considered a kind of a temporary disorder.
Mm-hmm.
Having an asthma attack was something that you had. And then what they used to do was get rid of the dust, get rid of the kittens, get the cats out of the house, get the dog. If you have serious asthma, get those allergens out of the way. But then they discovered drugs to control it.
Right.
So they left the allergens there.
Right.
See, now people, instead of cleaning up the allergens that they might have to clean up and not deal with, they left those around, and so they had an increased dependency on the medications.
Yeah.
And the medications eventually, in the United States, 3,880 people died of asthma in 1985, up from half that in 1977. You know, it's like it's a real paradox. People who are getting more and more treatment, there are more and more deaths from asthma.
Well, you know, when we look at medical paradoxes, Armand, we're looking at something, they all have something in common. And there was a professor, his name I think was Dean Black, who wrote a book called Health at the Crossroads. Some of you out there may be familiar with that book because it was a bit of a landmark. He wrote this book about the fact that in modern medicine, we witness this kind of a paradox in almost everything we do, meaning that when we try to control the body, starting from a good intention, like Armand says, with all good intentions, we try to help something that is annoying, disturbing, upsetting, uncomfortable, painful, distressing. We may be able in the moment to come up with a solution that relieves the symptom, but we're not looking at the price we may pay for that solution. Later on, it might end up being a lot more expensive than what we initially thought.
And it's not only those consequences, Roberta. You know, some of the ones I'm interested in is we don't consider, not that we could, there are things we cannot figure out, you know? We can't figure, how could this work back? Let me give you an example. From NutriBodies, an article. Hyponatremia, hope I'm pronouncing it right. You think that's right?
Hyponatremia.
Yeah. Water intoxication can lead to death. Now listen to this article. There was an old school advice. Drink a lot of water, right? You got to drink 16 glasses of water a day. Was it eight? What
it started out with eight, and but then it went up to a gallon a day.
Some people were
recommending a gallon a day.
And they said in particular, you drink it before, during, and after exercise. And what they found is a condition called hyponatremia, which is people who die when drinking too much water during exercise or after exercise, and when people drink too much water in general. Here's the way it works. Dehydration is a major problem with endurance sports. In order to avoid the negative effects of dehydration, athletes tend to drink well above their current needs. The negative effect of drinking too much fluid is hyponatremia. Hyponatremia is defined as a plasma sodium concentrate lower than 135 milliliters. When blood sodium gets low, the blood begins to dilute with water. Brain cells begin to absorb too much water, and the brain swells, pushing it against the skull. It leads to a seizure. The person stops breathing, and what do they die from? They die from hyponatremia, a waterlogged brain. Mm-hmm. So here we were,
it seems like a seizure.
So it would seem like such a good idea.
Mm-hmm.
Of course you drink as much water as possible.
Right. Right.
Of course, what they say now is, and now we learned, if you're going to drink a lot of water, take a lot of salt with it. Make sure you take sodium with it. Bring water with electrolytes. Mm-hmm. I like this one recently came out, and we're going to bring this to you, my friends. You're going to find things about yourself that you're going to say, well, yeah, this is all just what happens to medicine. You know, medicine is, but it's not only medicine, vitamins. What did we have with, didn't we have a great idea about drinking carrot juice for a while? Get rid of that Coca-Cola and drink some carrot juice, and the stand opened up downstairs, and they were making...
Not just carrot juice, but any kind of raw juice made a lot of sense, because juices contain all of the beneficial antioxidant phytochemicals, and when you remove the fiber, these nutrients are absorbed immediately through the intestinal wall. But also, what else do you absorb that was not taken into account? Well, everything that's living has a self-protective system. A plant does as well. So plants contain phytochemicals that are nutritive, and phytochemicals that are irritants. When you juice a plant, you remove the fiber, so yes, you absorb the nutrients much faster, but you also absorb the irritants much faster, and there you end up with diarrhea. A lot of people who started juicing...
In some cases.
Well, when people overdid it, because if you just have one cup of juice here and there, it's no big deal. But when people thought, oh, this is so good for me, let me drink a lot of it. I used to get a lot of calls from people who would tell me that they had juiced, you know, they had a quart of juice with some greens in it, and they had ended up with diarrhea.
Okay, well, we're not just talking about the negative effects of doing things. We're talking about the paradox of it. And the paradox of it is, doesn't it make sense that if you drink as many nutrients as possible, and again, we discovered juicing somewhere in the 70s, and carrot juice became real popular. And, you know, there is keratinosis, I think it's called.
That's the yellowing of the palms of the skin, which means a person has had a lot of carrot juice or...
But there's a toxicity
carotene.
That could happen.
But it's vitamin A that's toxic. It can be toxic when there isn't a... Vitamin A can be actually deadly when people take too much, and their liver are not able to... They don't have the enzyme that... converts it into carotene again. So it stores it and stores it and stores it and stores it until the liver reaches a level of toxicity that it can be lethal. So yes, even with vitamin A,
And these are not just the cautions that we would normally say. You know, everybody would say, well, if you're going to do this, watch out for this. You're going to do this, watch out for this. These are things we discovered after the fact. We didn't anticipate them. Here's one that came to my attention today from, where was this, from Department of Critical Care Medicine Pediatrics in the Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, Pittsburgh School of Medicine. This is just brilliant. Unexpected increased mortality after implementation of a commercially sold computerized physician order entry system. Get this. The idea was to develop the most interesting thing in the world, a computer in which you would feed your symptoms and you would write them into the computer. You would feed in all the symptoms you have and the computer would come back with feedback. And this feedback would be developed to you, and then it would tell you what you've got wrong and what you could possibly do. And among 1,942 people who were referred and admitted, 75 people died, accounting for an overall mortality rate of 2.86%, which is much higher than normal. In other words, this analysis... there's just some variables in here that did not get figured. The conclusion is that we had observed an unexpected increase in mortality coincident with this implementation. We can figure out why. It doesn't make any sense because all the information was accurate. But now we've learned there must be something about the human factor that is essential that we can't figure out. Well, I remember many years ago, I had a wave. Whenever people would come in to see me for the first time, I would always take a Polaroid photograph so that when they got in touch with me, I would ask for their permission. I would want to look at the photograph. If I was analyzing their file or I was looking at stuff that happened to them or for later periods, I'd pull up that photograph and look at the photograph, and it always reminded me. And then I had a friend who had a hospital in Chicago. He was the head of a hospital in Chicago. He saw me do this, and he said, that's a great idea. So they started photographing every patient that went into the hospital, a little computer photograph. And so then they would take the data, and they would send it along with everything they did in the hospital. And what they would do is if you were sending something down to a lab for analysis, along with it would go the person's file and a photograph of the person. Well, it reduced. What do you call the surgeries that they do in a hospital, Roberta, that only happen after you get in the hospital, but it's not what you go into the hospital for? There's a medical term for it.
I'm not sure.
It reduced those surgeries by 40%. You know the things you never expected to happen to you?
Oh, my God. Are you saying what I think you're saying?
Yeah, that when the pathologist got the information, he then looked at the picture. He said, oh, this person's got liver disease, according to the blood report I have here. And so he would send back a report to the doctor, you better do liver surgery on this person because that's what the pathology says. But then he looks at a photograph of the person, and when he sees a person's face, he says, but that person doesn't have liver disease because I know what people with liver disease look like. And they don't look like that.
Mm-hmm.
Or another pathology would say, oh, this person's got a thyroid misfunction. One look at the photograph and you say, oh, no, not that person. Or you would validate it. Oh, yes, that person does have a thyroid misfunction because I could see it in their eyes.
Mm-hmm.
So that reduced the incidence of these surgeries by 40% in the hospital. Yet not every hospital will take a photograph of every patient that comes in.
Well done, Armand.
Yeah.
What a great idea. Yes, paradoxes. What are we saying, Armand?
Well, we're saying that we're almost out of time because we have to take a short break.
Mm-hmm.
Let's give them a treat today.
Yes.
Okay? Instead of a paradox, we're going to give you some humor. We're going to play you something that's a little funny.
Oh, it's very funny.
It's very, very funny.
It is. Yes, it's quite a treat. Yes.
Well, we're going to do it as soon as we get back from our break, and then we'll be back with you.
W-B-A-I-W-B-A-I-W-B-A-I-W-B-A-I-W-B-A-I-W-B-A-I-W-B-A-I-W-B-A-I-W-B-A-I-W-B-A-I-W-B-A-I-W-B-A-I-W-B-A-I-W-B-A-I-W-B-A-I-W-B-A-I-W-B-A-I-W-B-A-I-W-B-A-I-W-B-A-I-W-B-A-I-W-B-A-I-W-B-A-I-W-B-A-I-W-B-A-I-W-B-A-I-W-B-A-I-W-B-A-I-W-B-A-I-W-B-A-I-W-B-A-I-W-B-A-I-W-B-A-I-W-B-A-I-W-B-A-I-W-B-A-I-W-B-A-I-W-B-A-I-W-B-A-I-W-B-A-I-W-B-A-I-W-B-A-I-W-B-A-I-W-B-A-I-W-B-A-I-W-B-A-I-W-B-A-I-W- Jazz Vipers at WBAI, New York City.
Good morning. I'd like to have an argument, please.
Sir, have you been here before?
No, this is my first time.
I see. Well, we'll see who's free at the moment. Mr. DeBakey's free, but he's a little bit conciliatory. No, try Mr. Barnard, room 12.
Thank you. What do you want?
Well, I was told outside.
Don't give me that, you snotty face of a parrot. Shut your festering gob, you tit. Your type makes me puke. You vacuous, stuffy nose. Malodorous pervert!
It's like any of an argument.
Oh, I'm sorry, but this is abuse.
Oh, I see.
No, you want room 12A next door.
Oh,
sorry. Not at all. Stupid git.
Is this the right room for an argument?
I've told you once.
No, you haven't.
Yes, I have.
When?
Just now.
No, you didn't.
Yes, I did.
You didn't.
I did.
You didn't.
I'm telling you, I did.
You didn't.
Well, I'm sorry. This is a 5-minute argument of the full half hour.
Ah, just the 5 minutes.
Just the five minutes. Thank you. Anyway, I did.
You most certainly did not.
Now, let's get one thing perfectly clear. I most definitely told him.
Oh, no, you didn't.
Oh, yes.
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 Oh, no, you didn't.
Oh,
no, you didn't.
Oh, yes.
You didn't.
Oh, yes.
You didn't.
Oh, yes.
No, you didn't. Oh, look, this isn't an argument.
Yes, it is.
No, it isn't. Just contradiction.
No, it isn't.
It is.
It is not.
You've just contradicted me.
No, I didn't.
We did.
No, no, no.
You did just that.
Nonsense.
Oh, this is futile.
No, it isn't.
Yes, it is. I came here for a good argument.
Ah, no, you didn't. You came here for an argument.
An argument isn't just contradiction.
Well, can be.
No, it can't. An argument is a connected series of statements intended to establish a proposition.
No, it isn't.
Yes, it is. It isn't just contradiction.
Look, if I argue with you, I must take up a contrary position.
Yes, that isn't just saying no, it isn't.
Yes, it is.
No, it isn't.
Yes, it is.
No, it isn't.
Yes, it is.
No, it isn't. Argument is an intellectual process. Contradiction is just the automatic gainsaying of anything the other person says.
It is not.
It is.
Not at all.
It is.
Thank you. That's it.
What?
That's it. Good morning.
But I was just getting interested.
Oh, I'm sorry. The 5 minutes is up.
That was never 5 minutes.
I'm afraid it was.
No, it wasn't.
I'm sorry, I'm not allowed to argue anymore.
What?
If you want me to go on arguing, you'll have to pay for another 5 minutes.
But that was never 5 minutes just now. Oh, come on! Oh, this is... This is ridiculous.
I told you I'm... I told you, I'm not allowed to argue unless you've paid.
Oh, all right. There you are. Well.
Well, what?
That was never 5 minutes just now.
I told you, I'm not allowed to argue unless you've paid.
Well, I just paid.
No, you didn't.
I did! I did! I did! I did! I
did!
Pay. I don't want to argue about it.
Well, I'm very sorry, but you didn't pay.
Aha! Well, if I didn't pay, why are you arguing? Ah! Gotcha!
No, you haven't?
Yes, I have. If you're arguing, I must have paid.
Not necessarily. I could be arguing in my spare time.
Oh!
What do you think, Roberta?
I love it. Monty Python, they're my favorite.
Monty Python, the Argument Clinic. This is Armand DeMille with Roberta Maria Atti. If you've just tuned into WBAI, we are a place of very serious stuff and a place of good humor. Humor certainly does lead us to a lot of what we have to do. Because, you know, we have to look at all this stuff we take so seriously. And we've got to figure the joke's on us. That's the way I see it.
Mm-hmm.
I figure, you know, it's not nice to fool Mother Nature. That was an expression. Did you ever hear that expression before?
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's like Mother Nature says we're going to do it one way, and it's not nice to fool Mother Nature. Let's take a look at Prozac for a moment. Now, I know many of you, I could tell you I've seen Prozac do some glorious things for people who, especially with obsessive compulsive disorders, and I know we have theories about how to treat them, and I could tell you dozens of ways, and But there are some people who have suffered for so long, and they've got on one of the SSRIs, and they're just the suffering lifted, you know. And I could tell you,
yes,
I've seen everything.
People like that too,
you know, Roberta, we've got medicine, we've got nutrition, we have electroshock therapy, we have brain transplants, not yet, but soon. And there we are. So Prozac comes along. It's done some great things. I've seen those whole serotonin reuptake inhibitors. But one of the things they found that among teenagers, and they were giving it to teenagers, one of the things they didn't expect is that teenagers, the rate of suicide among teenagers would increase. Well, that's pretty amazing. Meaning that teenagers would be sitting there with such repressed anxiety that once you gave them the Prozac that kind of lifted their depression, they just offed themselves.
Mm-hmm.
Interesting. But that's not the one that shocked me. The one that shocked me came out last week. New York Times article, report again on the Harvard Medical Letter. People over 60 who took Prozac and the other SSRIs had a higher incident of suicide than people who did not take it.
Mm.
Now, what does that mean? You know, and again, you know, you look at it and you say, what? What? You got them depressed and you just offed yourself?
Mm.
Maybe depression protects you against the misery
mm-hmm.
in some way that comes along with just getting ready to walk out on the ice.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Maybe it's just, you know, you get to be 60 years old and nature kind of said, you know, 60 now, that's about it for our young guys. And nature used to make you end your life right around then. That's why we set the retirement age at 65. And benefits go to you at 65 because nobody was expected to live that long to collect those benefits.
Right.
Right?
Right. Yeah, well, it makes sense. You remove the depression and underneath it you have the rage. And once you remove that safety layer, in a sense, that the depression represents, the rage is free to do whatever it might do.
I don't know what it is. I mean, I'm not sure if
well,
it's rage.
I mean, just from what you're saying.
Yeah, one way or another, it could just be the,
increased energy level.
Increased energy level.
With more serotonin, there's more energy, there's more activity in the muscles.
But if you would have asked me, if you would find a number of people 60 years old who have chronic depression of such a kind, such a deep kind, that they're practically hospitalized all the time. They go into nursing homes because their depression is so poor. And somebody would ask me, look, these are the people, we've tried everything with them, nutrition, we've tried everything else, nothing works. Would you give them Prozac? I would say yes. Yes. Would I anticipate that that group of people would get up, get undepressed, and jump off a bridge? No. I wouldn't anticipate that. It's one of those paradoxes we didn't figure out.
Mm.
We will from now on. Just like heroin. Remember when heroin was invented? What mm-hmm. was that, in the 30s?
Something like that, 30s or
Bayer
40s.
Bayer Aspirin Company invented heroin.
Mm-hmm. To treat morphine addiction, or actually as a substitute for morphine, because morphine was so addictive. Almost everyone who used it got addicted to it. So they figured out, let's figure something out to make something that works the same way but is less addictive. And that's how heroin was invented. And, you know, the rest is history.
And then after heroin?
Methadone, same thing.
What do you mean, same thing?
Same thing in the sense that methadone was created in an attempt to control heroin addiction and make it more manageable, thinking that if we were going to give methadone to people who were already addicted, they would stop using heroin and without suffering. And methadone is more addictive than heroin or morphine because the withdrawal from methadone is much more difficult to endure than the withdrawal from heroin or morphine. So, you know, again, another medical paradox that started with good intentions.
Makes the person who takes methadone eventually go to morphine.
Well,
you
I
know
mean,
what I mean,
yes, that's exactly
and the circle
what happens.
Happens.
Yeah.
Well, kind of an interesting one. Now comes one of the interesting ones, Viagra. Now, Viagra is fascinating because I can't tell you the number of people I know who've been waiting for the bad news on Viagra. They have been waiting to hear, and for a little while it came out that if you take Viagra, you lose your vision. And then, after that, you could go blind is part of what they said. It was interesting that they chose that you should go blind because it seems like, you know, Oedipus, who looked at his mother, would go blind,
mm-hmm.
you know, so on and so forth. So it's funny, they chose that, and then there was this thing called blue vision, that you would have a blue cast over your vision if you took Viagra. Well, I'm not saying anybody should take Viagra. However, Viagra seems to have been around now for 4 years, and there have been no serious consequences.
Mm-hmm.
Nobody understands why. Okay, so now that's the beginning. What do you think the paradox of Viagra is? Here's what it came out to be. 65-year-old man discovers, and he's married, and he's faithful. He's not interested in being with anyone else. Takes Viagra. He's with a woman, married to, who's gone through menopause, and is kind of peacefully settled into a sexless life. You know, and she's kind of said, okay, sex is gone, so now I'll live for my grandchildren. And, you know, and so there it is. And then suddenly here comes husband along, and his doctor had given him Viagra, and he takes the Viagra, and he says, look, I can have sex again. And the wife says, well, okay, let's have sex. And what turns out is that a number of women are requesting, demanding that their husbands do not take the Viagra because they don't want an active sex life again.
Mm.
And it's not that they're sending their husbands off to somewhere, but it's breaking up many marriages.
Mm.
Funny thing.
Yeah.
That which they call the thing that's going to heal everything. And then, of course, we have, you know, a number of other things that have happened in medicine. But now let me take you on a trip. Let me take you on a little journey that I kind of imagine I bring to people. When people come to see me for the first time, or they come to see anybody at the clinic that I run, we give them a thing called a style delineator. Now, what this is it's a very short fill-out form. It's not a test, but it looks like a test, where you fill out this form and you rank order 4 words. There are 4 words in a number of categories, and what this tells us, it tells us some interesting detail about the way that you rank order things, how you prioritize things. It also tells us the kind of thinker you are. Are you a thinker who likes to line up the ducks? Are you an artistic thinker? Are you a random thinker? Are you a sequential thinker? And that becomes very important information when we think about how we can help you with whatever psychological problems you may be having. But I was looking at it, and here's a question for you. I want you all to write down the following 4 words. Just 4 words. Objective. Evaluative. Sensitive. Intuitive. Now, I know you may be listening and you don't have a pencil in your hand, but good, write it down. Write it down. Objective is the first word. Evaluative. That means you evaluate things. Sensitive and intuitive. And it asks you, which of these 4 is the most like you? Now look at it and think, which of these 4 is the most like you? Do you know which one of the 4 is the most like you? I'm going to ask Roberta to take this right here. You know which one?
No, yeah, I do.
Okay, so put a 4 next to that one, Roberta.
Mm-hmm.
Put the number 4 next to that one. Put the number 1 in the one that is least like you. Put a number 2 in the one, and put a number 3 in the one that is second most like you, number 3.
Okay.
And put a number 2
in the other one.
In the other one.
Okay.
Okay, see, would you give me your 4?
Sure. Objective 2, evaluative 1, sensitive 3, intuitive 4.
Okay, so here it is. You are mostly intuitive.
Mm-hmm.
You are second most sensitive.
Yes.
Although that's a flip-up, right? I mean, you know, you could say, well,
what do you mean it's a flip-up?
I mean, usually between 3 and 4, it's a toss-up. You could have, I could be more sensitive sometimes, more intuitive other times.
Oh, I see what you mean.
But those are 2 definite qualities that you know you have, right?
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Okay, then third down the line comes evaluative, is it? Or objective is third, and fourth is evaluative.
Yes.
Now, let's say that part of the problem you came to me with in life is that you didn't know how to evaluate things.
Mm-hmm.
Now, how
like making decisions, I don't know how to evaluate the choice.
The choice between two things. Mm-hmm. You would like to have better skill at that.
Right.
Right? Would you like to have better?
Are you asking me? Yeah, in some things of, in my life, like, some areas of my life.
So let's say that we intensify this for you, and you don't have to talk about just yourself, you think about some of the people you know. And we increase this, we want you to be more evaluative, so we're gonna bring this up so that you could develop this skill, so that this skill steps up above another one. So where would we now take this least quality, the number one, and so we're going to try to put it up at a number three.
Mm-hmm.
Okay?
Right.
Okay, now what's number one?
I mean, the
first one is intuitive, right?
Right.
Now, the second one is going to be objective.
Uh-huh.
But that things we got means we got to take sensitivity and move it down.
I see. So you're
third
going
position.
To have to give up something that may be innate or that you may appreciate the fact that you have it.
For getting
in
what you want.
For what you're
well, nobody would expect that if you became more evaluative,
that's very interesting.
That you'd become less sensitive. But the truth of it is, if you became more evaluative, you would become less sensitive.
I would have to, sure.
You would have to, but do you want to give up that sensitivity to get it?
No.
Oh, wait a minute, though. I thought you said you wanted the objectivity.
Mm-hmm.
I thought you were buying that.
Yeah, I see what you mean.
But if I hang this this mandala on a wall,
mm-hmm.
and if you hang it in your house, you're going to become more objective. That's all you have to do.
More evaluative.
More evaluative. That's mm-hmm. all you have to do. And by the morning when you wake up, you'll be less sensitive.
I'm not sure I would trade if I knew that.
And that's
that was
the problem.
Cost.
There it is. The thing is that for everything we want, we're going to give up something one way or another, and we don't know it. Let's try another category.
Okay.
Careful with detail.
Okay.
Okay. The second category is ideas.
Mm-hmm. Ideas.
Yep. Third category is aware.
Mm-hmm.
And the fourth category is creative.
Oh, well, you know what the answer is there.
Okay, so let's start at the beginning.
Okay.
I want other people who are doing this to try it out. First category is careful with detail. Second category is ideas. Third category is aware. And the fourth category is creative. Now, which of these four is the most like you?
Are you asking me?
I'm going to let other people figure it out first. Okay, mm-hmm. So you're going to rank order. The most like you is number four. Second most like you is number three. Third most like you is number two. And the least like you is number one. Okay, Roberta, give it a shot.
Okay, most number four is creative.
You're the most is you are creative.
Mm-hmm. Three is aware. Two is ideas, and one is detail.
Just like on the chart, right? Just like that. One, two, three, four.
Yes. Just
careful with details. Okay, Roberta, now listen. You must be one of those people because I'm one of them too. Careful with details. Wouldn't you love to be more careful with details?
Oh, my God, would I ever.
Right? That means clean desks. It means things in
organized
order. It
life.
Means crossing
yeah.
the T's, dotting the I's.
Yeah.
Okay, which one do you want to give up?
Well, I don't.
No, but you have to. You're going to have to push it up. You're going to have less ideas. How about that?
No way.
How about you become a little less aware?
No way.
Okay, how about you drop down creativity?
Absolutely not.
Wait a minute, Roberta. Then you can't get careful with details.
Hmm. You mean creative, aware people with a lot of ideas have difficulties with details?
No, but if you prioritize creativity first...
I see.
You know what I mean? I mean, this is just the way it falls for you.
So it's about the choices we have.
And
what,
the problem is the way this scale was developed
mm-hmm.
was that, you know, people were saying, why can't I have both? The truth is you don't. It winds up, let's do another one, okay, since we've got a few minutes, people are enjoying this. Thorough.
Okay.
Thorough. Logical.
Okay.
Spontaneous.
Mm-hmm.
Or a troubleshooter. Now, whatever troubleshooter means to you, it means problem solver, troubleshooter, you find a problem, you get in there, you solve it. Spontaneous, logical, thorough.
Okay.
Okay, Roberta. And for everybody else writing it down, remember, four is the most likely troubleshooter.
Oh,
I know, but there's some other people who had to reap, they had to sharpen their
pencils.
You might
want to read them again.
Yeah.
Thorough.
Mm-hmm.
Logical. Spontaneous. Troubleshooter.
Good. What's your score, Roberta?
Number four, spontaneous. Number three, logical. Number two, troubleshooter. Number one, thorough.
Thorough, just like the careful with detail.
Yeah.
Right?
Matches, huh?
Right. So you would rather be more thorough, right? Wouldn't you like to add a little more thorough to your life?
That would make my life a lot easier.
Sure. Add a little more thorough to your life.
Mm.
Okay. Should we get you a little less logical?
I can't give up my logic.
But you have to give up just a little bit.
No.
Just
going to
move
it
down.
No. Nor my spontaneity. I would die if I couldn't be spontaneous.
How about being a troubleshooter, being able to solve problems quickly?
That's survival to me. It's something I need to survive. So thorough doesn't matter that much. It doesn't seem to be as important. And yet...
Yeah.
You
and there are people
who
scale this the opposite way, you know.
Of course.
There are people, let's go back to the other one, careful with detail, ideas aware and creative. Some people have creativity as their lowest score, and they have aware as their second score, ideas as their third, and careful with detail is the most like them.
Sure.
You ask them what they would like, they say, I want to be more creative. And I say, okay, could you reduce some of that awareness you have or attention to details?
They would never.
No, never.
Never, right.
Okay, we'll do one more.
This is so true.
It's interesting, isn't it?
Very, yeah.
Okay, and there's an argument against it, of course, and the argument is, of course, you could be both, but what I've found over the years is that you don't.
But it just gives you an indication. I mean, it's not an absolute, but it...
No, but when I'm working with people, there are so many nuances to this. Like if a person is very sensitive and they are very empathetic and they're very person-oriented, those are three scales.
Mm-hmm.
You put all three together, it always equals paranoia.
Huh.
It's a fascinating thing. I mean, I've worked with this for 20 years, yeah. Okay, let's go again.
Okay.
Here we go. Let's take that one with person product-oriented.
Product-oriented. Okay.
Critical judge.
Critical judge.
It's really, the word is judge, but it means being a critical judge.
Okay.
Person-oriented.
Person-oriented.
Or practical dreamer.
Practical dreamer. Okay. All right. Practical.
Product-oriented judge, person-oriented, or practical dreamer.
Mm-hmm.
What do you got?
Okay, give me a moment. okay, I got it.
What about you? It's number one.
Number one,
four.
You mean the number four. Practical dreamer.
Practical dreamer. Mm-hmm. Most of all, you love your dreams.
Yes.
Second most?
Person-oriented.
Right, and the bottom. Just give me the one.
Critical judge.
Critical judge. So you have this, you'd like to become a better critical judge, like you'd like to be more thorough, like you'd like to be more careful
detail,
with detail.
Yeah.
Right. Could you just move down that person-oriented thing of yours a little bit and not care so much about people? How about you just give up a little of your dreams?
Never. I couldn't. Nope.
Wish we could go further. Maybe we'll continue this tomorrow. This is Armand DeMille with you. It's a positive mind. Roberta Maria Atti.
And the paradoxes of life.
And the paradoxes of life. We'll be back with you soon. I'll be back tomorrow at 1 p.m., Roberta.
Just my website.
Sure.
I've renewed it, creativehealthsolutions.org. Check it out. It's really pretty.
And I will be back with you. I'll be back with you tomorrow at 1 o'clock. Sorry for the extra time, Michael. I'll be back with you tomorrow at 1 p.m., and you can catch our show. You can go to thepositivemind.com, but, you know, I think we're not going to be streaming for 2 days. So if you really want to hear today's program, go to WBAI.org. It's usually just a tiny bit more hard to negotiate, but should be able to get to it. If you want to reach me, it's Armand, A-R-M-A-N-D, at brainlink.com. Bye-bye for now, my friends. Bye-bye, Roberta. Thanks for your help.
Thank you.
WBAI, New York.